Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? Even the thought of it so absurd. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without books?
Where would we be?
Where would we be without Gutenberg?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm pleased to have as my guest, John Gulian. If you've ever wondered why a generation pierced itself, got tattoos, started wearing gender-bending clothes, his new book, The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt, may help explain what happened. Tell me about how this book came to be written, John.
It came to be written in a burst of, I won't say inspiration, but manic activity. It was 2008, and I was 4 months shy of turning 40, and I had done just about nothing with my life. I had a law degree I was not using. I had a federal clerkship under my belt. Never took the bar. I had been out of college now for 18 years and had only 3 short-term jobs to show for it. And my friends were running out of patience. My parents were running out of patience. And even I was running out of patience. Something had to give. And so standing at a bureau and writing in the body of an email and addressing it to one of my oldest friends, my best friend from college, Brent Forrester, who I knew would see immediately through any inauthenticity, any fronting, any BS on my part. I began to write my life story, trying to come to terms as best I could with why, despite being well-educated, and despite having been raised by parents who wanted me to make the best use of my intelligence, and despite being surrounded by friends who wanted me to make the best use of my intelligence, I had trouble just getting out of bed in the morning. And this book is the result of 3 years of work, most of which was spent thinking about my life, and about 4 months of which in 2 separate bursts of activity. 2 months in the summer of 2008, and then 2 months a year later in the summer of 2009. The first burst being the first draft of this book, the second burst being the second draft. It was dramatically restructured, this book, for the second draft. I came up with The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt.
I think that there are millions of people, I mean brilliant people and interesting people, who've lost the ability to get out of bed or even never had it, and that this is one of our secrets, that education and the best of intentions are often as debilitating as anything that you can find. And people knowing and telling you what they expect of you is one of the scariest things that an intelligent person can have to live with.
I won't disagree.
But why do you suppose that is? What happens? Why does a person turn off to everyone's good feelings about you?
I don't know if I would characterize myself as having turned off from people's good feelings about me, but I simply felt I couldn't live up to their expectations of me. If I had to reduce the theme of this book to as few words as possible, I would say it's about the burden of other people's expectations.
Yeah, because, you know, I felt a lot of identification when I was reading this book. And I suppose in part it's that, Like most people, I love to read in bed. So I'm another person who was scolded with not getting out of bed, when the truth was I was reading everything humanly known between the covers. Between the covers of a book, between the covers of the bed, it was a version of my home. It was where I was doing my preparation.
Then you were definitely spending your time in bed much more constructively than I was. Yeah, I wasn't doing much reading. I was mostly staring at the ceiling.
Uh-huh. And what did you see there?
A great blankness. I wasn't proud of myself for resisting people's expectations.
Did your sense of a burden, did that go beyond your family?
Absolutely. It was also the burden of my friends' expectations. And not to speak too broadly, but it was the burden of, I don't want to say society's expectations, but certainly the community in which I was raised. It was a hyper-competitive group of largely Jewish kids in La Jolla, California, where I grew up. And when I hit adolescence, when we all hit adolescence, it was no longer simply play the sport that you happen to be good at, which in my case was soccer, but it was now play the sport that you happen to be good at in order to get into the best college possible. It was all about getting into the best college possible. It was no longer simply doing your homework when you got home from school. It was now doing your homework in order to get into the best college possible. And for me, it was an especially difficult burden because my two older brothers had set what I felt to be an impossible standard of success for me to live up to when I was 13 years old. They both went off to college simultaneously. They were not twins. The middle one skipped two grades. So the oldest went off to Yale and the middle one skipped two grades and went to Harvard at the age of 16 to study theoretical physics. 4 years later, when I was now applying to college myself, the one who had gone to Yale was now at Harvard Law School. The one who had gone to Harvard was now in graduate school at Harvard, getting his PhD in physics at the age of 20. And call me a wimp, but that was a lot for me to live up to. And I turned away rather than facing the challenge head on. And I began to drop all the hardest classes that I had been taking. And started wearing women's clothing.
Now, I'm talking to John Gulian about his book, The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt. And one of the things that I love about this book, I can see it so clearly. Here is this family of high-achieving, transplanted New Yorkers. Mother, a late-in-life lawyer. Father, a hematologist.
And a biochemist as well.
Right? Yes. Two high-achieving brothers. They've moved from New York to La Jolla. And what's going to be said? You never blame your child. Blame it on the beach. Blame it on beach culture. What got said about the beach and its pernicious effects?
Actually, nothing. They never blamed my lack of ambition and my lethargy on beach culture. They were actually unfamiliar with beach culture because they never went to the beach. They didn't move to La Jolla for the beach. They moved there because of UCSD, University of California at San Diego. The medical school there drew a lot of Northeasterners out in the 60s. No. They offered me no crutch for my deadbeat ways. They just held me responsible as an individual.
It seemed to me that you were for them a new creature, and they must have had a lot of hypotheses about the reason, whereas you were really a mystery, sort of like Bartleby the Scrivener, who appears in your book.
I'm not aware of any hypotheses that they had about my transformation at the age of 16 from a jock and a scholar into a zoned out androgyne. They greeted that transformation purely with exasperation and mystification.
And eventually, it's such an impossible subject that they don't exactly talk to you about it. You get periodic letters.
Later in life, from my father, though not about my transformation. It was those letters were addressing my refusal to work or do anything with my life.
And he basically seems very apologetic. You'll excuse me, but I have no idea what to think of you. Can you help me understand you?
Apologetic might be too charitable interpretation of the tone of those letters. At the time, I found them quite aggressive, and I think they were aggressive.
And your grandmother. Your grandmother seems to be one of the people who loved you and whose love you enjoyed, except she too had her expectations. What did she want?
You're speaking now of my maternal grandmother, the Shamaram, my
yes.
Armenian grandmother.
Granny
Shammy. She was obsessed with me going to medical school. She craved symmetry in life, and she had a doctor in every generation leading up to mine. And well, maybe symmetry isn't the right word, but well, consistency, I should say. And neither of my two older brothers had any plans of being a doctor. So the burden fell on me to carry on the tradition. And beginning when I was about 11 years old, she made it clear to me she wanted me to be a doctor. And she never let up. And I was so reluctant to let her down that I lied to her and told her, yes, I am going to be a doctor, and kept that lie going until the day she died.
Strangely, in this book, it's almost buried, but two books are of enormous significance. You take the information in the books as being a banner, but I have the feeling that what you reveal is that the way to get to John Gulyan is on the page in a book. You read the book Muscle by Fussell, and you decide the way to build an armor is to become a muscle man, a bodybuilder. The four pages or five that you tear out are his diet and his routine. And another book written by a parent whose child was murdered in New York City produces in you a fear that leads you to feel that you need an armor. So books have this odd subliminal effect on you.
The effect is more overt than that. I wouldn't say it's subliminal. In those two cases, it was quite conscious. In the case of the Victim Song, that's the book you were referring to, by the mother of the boy who was murdered in 1980. Right, that's a book. I think I say it in The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt. It's the only book I think I've read cover to cover without moving. I read it 12 hours before moving to New York to go to Columbia. And no, it was not a subliminal effect. That was a quite consciously terrifying story I read. And it completely changed the nature of my experience in New York City. I haven't been able to stand on a subway platform ever since then without looking over my shoulder constantly. Her son was stabbed to death and pushed off the subway platform onto the tracks. And in the case of Muscle by Sam, I don't know if it's Fussell or Fussell, which I read in the early 90s, again, I quite consciously emulated his strategy for dealing with the perils of life.
And well, what I think of as being subliminal is that they were books, not TV shows or videos, that you were taking in the enormous power of the printed word, and that eventually, strangely, the solution to whatever this is that you would write a book yourself. It was thrilling for a bookworm like me for books to attain such huge importance in a life.
And as a result, thousands of teenagers across the country who are now reading my book are going to be just as I emulated Sam Fussell. We're going to be wearing women's clothing.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Jangoulian. He's the author of The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm talking to John Jangoulian. Have you ever been called or considered yourself a freak or a misfit? If so, this is the book for you. It's The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt. And for me, I was a different kind of freak and misfit, and maybe an earlier generation model. You know, they started turning out my model in 1964. I was born in 52. But all of the symptoms are there in place. The, you know, everyone loving me and being unable to account for a turning away from that willingness of the world to hold out its arms to me. And it seems to me that you come, you know, stagger into freakdom through no willing fault of your own.
I agree. When I started wearing women's clothing at the age of 16, it was not a conscious effort to turn myself into a freak. It was not a conscious effort to resist convention. This is not a book about a rebel, and I've never thought of myself as a rebel. A rebel is someone who aggressively asserts his individuality in the face of the pressure to conform, and that is not the person in this book. I wanted badly to conform. I wanted badly to go to the best college imaginable. I wanted to go to Harvard. I wanted to go to Yale, just like my older brothers. And I wanted to be sexually normal, like all my friends. I wanted to hook up with the cutest girls at school. But out of an inability to conform, in the case of my academic performance, because I was scared I wouldn't do as well as my older brothers, and in the case of my sexual behavior, I was very self-conscious about my body and didn't feel up to that challenge. Out of an inability to conform, as I discovered in the course of writing this book, I turned to women's clothing subconsciously, I feel, in an effort to change the terms by which I was judged. It was a way of putting up a front and as a way of distracting people's attention from me. I felt, at least my best guess of why I did this, I felt that maybe nothing would be expected of me if I behaved in a way that resisted expectations. Certain things are expected of boys in this world, and certain things are expected of girls, but maybe nothing would be expected of an androgynous freak. Unfortunately, it's not the way it turned out. No less was expected of me, and even worse, I was greeted with exasperation, mystification, and when I got to Columbia in 1986, with outright hostility from the football players on campus.
Now, let's quickly clarify. You're not a transvestite.
Right.
You're not a pre-op transsexual. You're not a homosexual. You are someone who likes to alter appearance not only by wearing lip gloss and women's clothing and earrings sometimes, but you also like tattoos and bodybuilding. You like to locate yourself, it seems, as the center of contradictions.
You know, I'm not sure if I actually like to do it. I just do it.
And it's out of a sense, it seems to me, and I've met people like this, and it's true of some of my very best friends. Any criticism is unbearable, not just harsh criticism. Anything that says you are something other than what you ought to be, Mr. Gulian, is really soul-shriveling.
It used to be soul-shriveling, but I've become inured to it.
Yes. So inured in the sense, do you think you'll be dressing this way 20 years from now?
I have no idea. My dad the other day, after a three-year reprieve, he asked me what's next after the book. And I told him I have no idea. I mean, I live largely day to day.
Well, I feel, not that it's any of my business, but I feel like you've discovered what you are, or one of the things you are, that you're a writer. One of the things that's true of a writer is that while a writer may have a look, a writer doesn't need to have a body, you know, words on the page. It's sort of like radio. No one needs to know what we look like, you and I, sitting here talking to one another, and I feel like the book, The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt, is a way of saying who you are without your having to prove it. You know, here it is. The book takes the place of the person who's unbearably conscious, self-conscious.
Until you turn the book over and you see the full body shot of me on the back.
But it seems like you would be proud of that.
I think you might be giving me more credit than I deserve. I don't come up at the end of this book with any definitive appraisal of who I am or why I turned out the way I did. I do come up with a theory for why I started wearing women's clothing at the age of 16. But there's a lot more in this book that needs to be explained. For instance, why I can't keep a girlfriend for longer than 2 weeks, it seems.
Well, that's an improvement in the book. You say 45 minutes.
Well, that's the average length of my romantic engagements is 45 minutes. So this is a book about not knowing necessarily who you are or why you are who you are, but still going on with life and making people laugh in the process of describing your life.
And what about for those people who would say, hey, I think he looks cool. I think he's fashionable. I like this. I don't have any negative response to it.
Great.
Have you come to that point?
It's not a question I even ask myself. It really isn't. Yeah, my life is lived far less deliberately than I suppose it ideally should be.
Toward the end of the book, a series of not answers exactly, but possible explanations arrive. You're at a farewell party for the soccer coach who is now soon to die of cancer. But he is the person, even after he stopped being your coach, who's remembered as always having encouraged, never criticized you. You know, add away, John, you know, you're great. As compared to the maternal grandmother, who's quite tough, and the mother and the father and the whole lineup of people who've always presented you with a still higher bar to hop over. So then we get this ray of hope that if you ever, you say to someone, if you were to ever write something that you thought was worthy of being sold, that you would sell it.
That was my response to my father's second letter when I, in, in that he sent to me in 2005 when he was trying to come to terms with my existence. And his best guess, he says, was that I had some sort of creative project that I was working on. And he wondered if that was true. And I said, yes, it is true that I am working on something and that I would sell it when the time came to sell it.
So what was that experience of writing like for you? Did it become satisfying?
It was torturous. It was wholly torturous. In part because I have trouble sitting still, and writing requires sitting still. So I ended up standing when I wrote it and literally dancing on the tips of my toes, standing at a bureau.
Did you know that there are writers who've made quite a point that they always stood when writing? Vladimir Nabokov among them?
I've been told that Philip Roth writes standing because of a bad back, and that Hemingway, and also Donald Rumsfeld.
Has this book brought you any kind of relief?
Absolutely. It certainly legitimized me in the eyes of my parents in many ways, and also in the eyes of a lot of my friends who were largely accepting of me, but who were a little impatient, a little exasperated with what they felt to be was a complete waste of my talents. And so it certainly brought me relief from their gentle criticism.
I've been speaking with John Guillen, author most recently of The Man in the Gray Flannel Skirt. It's published by Random House. And, you know, I really think it's a book secretly about how writing saved someone, how writing saved a soul, and there's nothing that could possibly make me happier. So thank you for joining me, John.
Thanks for having me.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.